The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. I have spent much of the last week at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, where I live, consuming content that we will be talking about on this show in the weeks and months to come. But for now, we're going to talk about a couple of other things that are either in theaters or on your television. As we speak, I'm going to speak with contributor Scott Gold about the new Daredevil series on Disney Plus, the new Marvel Cinematic Universe Daredevil series, Daredevil Born Again, starring Charlie Cox and Vincent D'Onofrio and a cast of many others. It is quite good and quite street level and quite gritty, and it brings Marvel down to earth a little bit, and we like it a lot. And I'm also going to talk to Stephen Garrett, our chief film critic, about Bong Joon-ho's Mickey 17, which is a sci-fi satire movie that is in theaters now. And Stephen and I are going to get into Mickey 17 right after this interlude.
Hey, Mickey.
Mickey.
Hey, Mickey.
Hey, Mickey.
Oh, Mickey, I really hate dying, but I was expendable.
Hey, Mickey!
Every time you die, humanity moves forward.
This Mickey's special.
I'm fine. See you tomorrow.
I was just saying to Stephen Garrett before I started recording, it's not like Mickey 17 mania is sweeping the nation. There's sort of an opposite thing going on where this is a movie that is almost instantly falling into the category of a movie that people who like it really like it, but I don't think it's going to have a broad, popular appeal. Mickey 17 is our movie of the week. It is the new movie from director Bong Joon-ho, who was last seen winning an Oscar for Parasite in 2019. And Stephen Garrett is here, and we are going to discuss Mickey 17. He has written a review of it for Book and Film Globe. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Which version of Stephen am I talking to?
Stephen 12.
Stephen 12. Yeah, okay. Stephen 12. You die on the page.
I do, actually, yes. And then you print me out again.
We print you out again, and you just keep going to the movies. All right. So this is it's a cloning movie.
Yeah.
Cloning would be the main theme of the movie. But I also, before we talk about that, it's kind of like, to me, it's like the ultimate March movie, where it's not like a January dump, and it's not quite a summer blockbuster. It reminds me of the, in some ways, not necessarily in tone, but in the sort of the, it's expensive, but not really a tentpole vibe of like 2023's The Creator. You remember that one? The one with the robots?
Oh, that was, yeah.
That was a real turkey. This is not a real turkey.
Well, you know, it's funny though that you mention that, because also like I feel like my favorite sci-fi March release of just like, we have no idea what this is or who would see it, is The Matrix, which came out, actually, I think, Easter weekend.
I guess it was one of those Easters that was in March. And that was a March release, huh? That was not a summer release. Because they didn't know what it was going to be.
They didn't know. They were like, what the hell is this? And remember, the marketing campaign was, what is The Matrix? Because they were like, people don't even know what this word means, you know? So it was an education process as well as like an entertaining. Look, this is no Matrix, but it's also no Creator.
No. I would say it definitely falls on the scale between the two. But that's interesting that the tradition of the sci-fi unmarketable big budget March release is actually it's got a long tradition in Hollywood.
It's just February, March is sometimes one of these weird months where great movies come out. Silence of the Lambs came out Valentine's Day, you know? And again, another one of those like, we think it's great, but who else is going to see this? Like, it's a wild card.
Yeah, well, the this movie, Mickey 17, is definitely a wild card. I mean, it features, you know, it has incredible star power. I mean, I guess Robert Pattinson is Batman.
That's right.
You know, and he's the, and it has an Oscar, made by an Oscar winning director. It's got a, I would say that, you know, Robert Pattinson, Mark Ruffalo, Toni Collette, you know, veering toward an A-list cast.
Totally.
You know, a $120 million budget, a large cast of fur-covered space tardigrades.
Creepers, right? Is that what they call them? Creepers?
I think that was mostly CGI. There may have been some practical effects.
They're going cute. Cute little bugs.
They're tardigrades. They're not. They're like kind of mammal mammal arthropods. There's a lot of aliens, actually. But, you know, this movie is it has a very muddled thematically, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, Ebong maybe wants to make a statement about the inhumanity of capitalism, you think?
Yeah, yeah, maybe. Apparently, late-stage capitalism is not good for the human race.
I would say...
That's the hot take.
I also don't think that Bong wears a MAGA hat when he goes to the grocery.
Right.
You know, Mark Ruffalo is this is the leader of basically like a political religious cult, right?
Right, exactly. With shades of MAGA, but also feels very niche in a weird way because they're all going off to space to start kind of an Elon Musk type, let's regenerate the human race, interplanetary, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So there's like this Christian cult, a Christian sex cult that wants to terraform a snow planet. And you know, it's only set at like 30 years in the future, but, you know, Earth does not look very pleasant.
No.
as usual in the future. And people are heading off into space to try to, you know, they're trying to take humanity to the stars, like Elon Musk is asking us to. And, you know, there's this moment where Naomi Ackie plays Robert Pattinson's lover in the movie. And there's a moment where she's like, she yells something like, "You stupid little man, why don't you just leave us all alone?" And it just felt like, I felt like she was like a typical Democrat just yelling at Twitter.
Right.
You know, it was so on the nose, you know? I'm like, come on. You know, people just, everyone, take a breath here. You know, but my main problem with the movie, Stephen, is that it's kind of a movie of two halves, right? The first half is almost all like whiny Robert Pattinson voiceover.
Yeah, but a really hilariously whiny voiceover.
Yes.
That he apparently said he wanted to sound like Steve Buscemi from Fargo.
Sure.
He's kind of a dummy. He's like a big dummy. He's a big whiny dummy. Hey, you know, I guess I die again. Okay,
here we go. I guess I'm gonna...
Mickey 18 doesn't sound that way. Mickey 18 has got that Batman voice, at least a little bit closer to
it. Yeah, Mickey 18's got some more cojones. But Mickey 17 has a good heart. But the thing is, but yes, sure, but there's so much voiceover that it doesn't allow... It was almost jarring when that voiceover kind of stopped in the second half of the movie, and we sort of were just watching scenes from the movie, right? I'm like, oh, am I gonna have to watch scenes without a voiceover explaining to me what I'm looking at? I hate voiceovers.
You hate voice? Well, you know, there was a long kind of tradition of there was a rule of thumb that if there was a lot of voiceover in a Hollywood movie, that means that the movie got into trouble. And didn't make sense. So the executive said, add voiceover to explain it. Like Blade Runner is the most egregious example of that, although I kind of like that voiceover. But, you know, in the right hands, like Casinos, you know, Scorsese's Casino, it's a 3-hour movie. The first hour is nothing but voiceover, wall-to-wall voiceover. And then he drops it, you know. So it's a conceit. I didn't mind it too much.
This is not Casino. to say the least, and this is not Blade Runner. It's not, you know, it doesn't even come close to those two. You know, the real problem. Two problems I had in the movie. One was the voiceover.
Yeah.
The other was Mark Ruffalo.
He is silly. Yeah.
That's generous.
I mean, it's basically his character from Poor Things, right? Like he's playing like the fatuous chauvinist and idiot.
Yeah, but I thought he was awful. I mean, yes, he's a satirical figure, but I feel like in order for the movie to be truly effective, he would have had to have been perhaps a bit more menacing, You know, I wouldn't have followed this guy to go buy a donut, much less into outer space.
I think this is the problem. And maybe that's why Parasite works so well, is that it's actually more than reality. And you can actually believe that these people exist in a world that you recognize. Whereas when he gets a little flights of fancy, or he becomes too broadly satirical with like this movie or Okja or Snowpiercer, like the metaphors really hit you over the head. Characters are really broad and cartoonish, you know, where it's like Jake Gyllenhaal in Okja, if you remember his like weird maniacal zoo guy, or like Tilda Swinton in Snowpiercer with her weird bottleneck glasses and the, you know, the whatchamacallit, the fake teeth and the weird accent. He goes broad when he does satire, and it can be scattershot.
Well, we have to remember he is Korean. So,
and it's not his main language. Yeah, there's some weird cultural translation things. The obsession Toni Collette has with making sauces out of the tails of these weird aliens. You know, and I he said in interviews like, oh well, you know, in Korea, like making the correct sauce for something is like a real art.
Yeah, I went to a Korean restaurant in Los Angeles after I lost on Pop Culture Jeopardy, and there was literally a wall of jars of sauce making of like,
is that
of,
right?
like fruit fermenting fruits and like, you know, various other like, I'm like, it looked like is that a pig fetus, you know, and it was just like she's like, the owner was like, well, that's how I make my sauces. But she wasn't sinister. She wasn't sinister and wearing horrible yellow dresses like Toni Collette in this movie. It was still, the food was delicious. And in fact, it was there's this restaurant, I remember the name of it, in Los Angeles, where it is most famous for being the restaurant that the cast of Parasite went to after they won the Oscar.
Oh, wow. There you go.
And it was very sauce heavy. So, okay. So that
he's very saucy. He's a saucy director. Let's face it.
He is a saucy director. And, you know, and look, I mean, you know, this movie is not boring. You know, I was never
definitely bored. Not bored.
I was never bored. But I was annoyed by a number of things in it. And I felt like, you know, we've been comparing it to a lot of movies. We sort of mentioned Blade Runner. We mentioned The Creator, The Matrix, all that. But it really, to me, the movie I think it's the most direct analog to is Starship Troopers. Paul Verhoeven's Starship Troopers. It's sort of like the space tardigrades, which never get a species name, are sort of a kind analog to the bugs in Starship Troopers.
That's interesting. Yeah,
and the sort of which was the ultimate, one of the greatest sci-fi movies ever made, I think, and is a excellent adaptation of a sci-fi work of literature. This is also, Mickey 17 is also an adaptation of a novel of some, I don't really know, I'm not familiar with the novel source material.
Mickey 7, there are only seven clones of Mickey.
Yeah, well, so, you have more room to play.
But you know, I was going to say, it's interesting you bring up Starship Troopers, because that's a tonally really, it's a movie you really got to see on Verhoeven's terms, you know, and Verhoeven has a very, very, I don't want to say ham-fisted, because there's a lot of nuance in his very broad strokes and in his kind of aggressively satirical approach, you know?
Yeah.
There's something so, I mean, it's a movie about fascism, right? More than anything else.
And militarism, and manipulation. Yeah.
And militarism, but it's crossed with like the DNA of like Beverly Hills 90210. You know what I mean? Like there's a really funny, I was thrown when I first saw it, like what was it, 97 or whenever it came out. And I couldn't quite get into the tone of it. And then as the years passed and I'd watch it again, and I'd just be like, this movie's kind of genius, like low key genius. I don't think Mickey 17 is that kind of thing, because I think Verhoeven really commits to his satire. I feel like Verhoeven, I don't know, he's, as I said, he's aggressively satirical. There's something that's really, like, he's very committed. He's very seriously committed to satire, whereas I think Bong is just kind of amused by his satire and kind of takes his foot off the pedal there every so often.
The difference is I felt like at the time it came out, you know, that was a time of aggressive U.S. militarism, right? Starship Troopers had some real teeth to it, I felt like.
Yeah.
And like I said, I feel like, you know, the satire is not very strong or funny in this movie, really. Like, you know, he does, yes, he's, I guess, suppose he's against Christianity and against, he doesn't, but the politics don't really have any anything to ground themselves in. So you can't really understand what you're supposed to be making fun of, what you're supposed to be angry at. It's just this sort of like whiny yawp against Trump, but it's not, but it doesn't really land. The Elon Musk stuff, which is sort of in the background, doesn't really land either. You know, the anti-cloning stuff, the pro-humanity stuff, it's like, yeah, okay, we get it.
I mean, exactly. I think for me, the stuff that really caught my imagination and got me kind of thinking in a really fun way was the just that concept of like, what do you do? Like, if you could literally like just reprint your body, then what value does life have?
Well, I mean, for me, it'd be you could watch so much more TV.
Well, but the thing is, too, like, it's funny you course rightly call this a cloning movie. I didn't think of it as a cloning movie per se, in the sense that when you think of clones, you think of multiple versions of one person. And of course, that happens at a certain point in this movie. But the first half, especially for me, I loved in this movie because it wasn't so much, it was sequential cloning, right? Like, he never met his previous version, because you only make a new version once he's dead. So then it becomes much more this sense of like, what is the true value of his life? And you'd see him kind of mingling with his other kind of passengers on the spaceship, or the other, you know, kind of people in the cult. And they don't really think Mickey's life has any value, because of course they can just reprint it. And so the way they consider him in their world, in their
the way some of them consider him.
But I think I thought that was really kind of wild. And then, you know, that little backstory where they talk about the scientist who came up with the cloning idea and actually did clone himself, and then was a serial killer, like was a sociopath. And then there was a question of like, who do we put on trial? I thought that was like, I love that kind of stuff. I love that sort of hypothetical.
Yeah, but that's all. But it was all told through voiceover. And, you know, and it's just kind of like,
no, it's not developed. It's underdeveloped. No,
flashbacky voiceovery. You know, this is, you know, again, I just feel like this is not a diamond, you know,
it's a diamond in the rough. I think there's some great ideas. Yeah. I think he succumbs to his kind of his propensity to be a little silly, a little wacky.
Yeah.
You know, let's have more montages of somebody throwing up blood. Yeah. Instead of like actually dwell on the implications of what we're doing.
It's really more of a late night film festival movie disguised as a big studio release. And which is, so it's a B picture. I think it's a B picture.
It's a B picture. Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting that this guy wins an Oscar, a surprising Oscar, you know, for the first time a South Korean film, a foreign language film, has ever won an Oscar for Best Picture, I believe, and then follows it up with like a kind of a satire sci-fi B picture about space tardigrades and clones. It's weird.
That's the thing. When he goes sci-fi, he gets silly, you know? Yeah. I think The Host is the least silly of his sci-fi monster movies, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that was a little bit more mythological, like a little bit of a fairy tale vibe of like this dark monster and the girl who goes lost and you know. You know, when he does Parasite, when he does this other more kind of socio kind of commentary that are grounded in reality, that's where he really sings.
Yeah. You know? This one does not necessarily. All right, Stephen, well, I'm gonna go kill myself and then print myself out again, and then I'll go see Mickey 17. Again,
I will probably see this again, or at least, really? You know, my no. clone would probably love, there will be, there's a clone of me that would probably love this movie nonstop.
Yeah. It's because like Michael Keaton in Multiplicity, your clones are just going to get progressively dumber and dumber. All right. Stephen Garrett has written about Mickey 17 in this week's Book and Film Globe. Stephen, I will talk to you or some version of you later.
That's fair.
It's going to get good.
Been some time, hasn't it? You've come up in the world.
I could say the same about you.
I wonder if your darker half would agree.
Exactly what kind of a lawyer are you?
A really good one.
We have a long road ahead of us. Much to do.
Daredevil has joined the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Well, I guess he joined it a while ago. He's been a guest star. The character has been a guest star on a couple of TV series. But now they have fully integrated the Daredevil character into the MCU. They've rebooted Daredevil in a show called Daredevil Born Again. And our contributor, Scott Gold, has written about it or is about to write about it for Book and Film Globe. And he's going to somersault into the recording here now and talk to me about Daredevil. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Neil. Great to be back on the podcast.
Always good to talk to you. So, all right. So Daredevil ran for 3 seasons on Netflix. It was part of this like Netflix street level heroes Marvel universe, right?
That's right. Yeah, there was Daredevil, Punisher, Luke Cage, Golden Fist,
Jessica Jones.
Iron Fist. The one that everybody very conveniently forgets.
But he had 2 seasons, and they did a team up called the Defenders, which was quite bad.
Right. Yeah. It was very bad, and I think that was kind of the death knell for the Marvel series on Netflix. But since Disney Plus has been picking up all the Marvel stuff, they've been slowly bringing back some of the more favorite characters, including Daredevil, thank goodness, because he was a fan favorite and a favorite of mine. And the Netflix series was brilliant. They were doing some really cool stuff. The cast was great. I mean, Charlie Cox is wonderful. Deborah Ann Woll is always wonderful. And they had some, you know, there was the hallway fight scene was the big water cooler discussion piece. Really long fight scene in a hallway that was just really innovative and super cool and really gave the aesthetic to the Daredevil series. And we haven't really had a whole lot of that on Disney yet. And so I think it's really exciting that, first of all, they're just bringing back Daredevil, and he's such a great character because, you know, he's not just kind of a schmuck who's a superhero. He's a lawyer. He's an educated guy. He's kind. He's intelligent. He's blind, but he's kind of not blind. That's the interesting thing, is that all of his other senses are heightened. And we'll talk about this in a second. The way that they handle that in the show, I think they do it really effectively. But he's a really interesting character, and he's surrounded by interesting characters, including the bad guys, primarily Wilson Fisk, the Kingpin, played just absolutely brilliantly by Vincent D'Onofrio in just a career performance that is powerful and deeply unsettling. And I think it's just really, really great to see it come back on TV, to come to Disney Plus, and that the fact that they're keeping the violence, they're keeping it gritty, and also it's very easy to tell that they have upped the budget, especially with what we're seeing on screen with some of the more elaborate shots, like rooftop chases that wouldn't, you know, they would be like shortcuts on Netflix just to kind of trick our eyes into thinking that there's actually a chase. But we get like long tracking shots across rooftops, and it's really cool to see. But I'm in it for the characters. I'm in it for the story. I know John Bernthal's Punisher or Frank Castle is going to be coming back this season as well, which is super exciting. And if you like Daredevil, if you like comic books, this is a good one, man.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I liked the Daredevil Netflix show, but I admit that I kind of faded out from it after a while because it was a lot of episodes and a lot of them were real talky and they didn't really kind of get to the action. And the thing about Daredevil that's so great is, yes, you're right, Matt Murdock, who is Daredevil's alter ego, is he's a smart, sensitive man, but he also is just an absolute beast when he gets angry. Not like the Hulk, but he makes Batman look like a patsy when he gets mad. And not to give too much away, you know, Daredevil hangs up the horns early on in the first episode, but I know for a fact, I mean, it's got to be that he's going to obviously put the suit back on soon enough.
Oh, I mean, obviously it's going to happen. Like you can't have a Daredevil series without Daredevil. And it's a trope, you know, it's a tried and true trope in comics and movies about, you know, the superhero who is hanging up his spurs, the cowboy really, who's hanging up his spurs and trying to be good and trying to be legal and do it the right way. And then, of course, something's going to happen that's going to bring him back. And in this case, there are a couple of inciting incidents. The first one, and I'm going to go ahead and just shout spoiler alert. Can we spoil the big thing in episode one?
I mean, if you're on the internet, you're going to know. Go ahead.
So in the first episode, again, massive spoiler alert for anyone listening. We get the absolutely shocking and tragic murder of Foggy Nelson, the beloved attorney character who was Matt Murdock's partner and friend, as well as Karen Page.
Karen was not murdered. Just to make it clear,
Karen was not murdered, but Foggy was murdered. Karen was there,
right,
at his side, and of course Matt puts on the suit and goes after the assailant. We don't know why he was going after Foggy, probably just to hurt Matt, because this was Bullseye, Dex Poindexter, which just hilarious character name, by the way. An absolutely unhinged, insane, very talented at murder bad guy. You know, Matt decides to drop him off a building, which doesn't kill him because he's a superhero. And this spurs the inner conflict of Matt Murdock, who decides, you know, in wrestling with his, you know, his Catholicism and his spiritual nature and his soul, decides that he doesn't want to do this anymore. He doesn't want to kill people. He doesn't want to participate in these actions anymore. So he hangs up his horns and decides to just do the good stuff being a lawyer. And that is complicated when Vincent D'Onofrio's kingpin Wilson Fisk decides to run for and wins the mayorship of New York City, setting them up for a massive tete-a-tete coming down the line. And it's going to be really, really fun to see how that plays out. But even at this point, you know, just two episodes in, there's a lot of inner conflict. There's a lot of outer conflict. There are a lot of really cool fight scenes. I am digging it. It really does feel to me that Disney took the notes. Like, they learned the lesson. They took the notes. They listened to whoever they had to listen to. And they picked up the series and all of the good things about it up in a way that is very, very satisfying for people who enjoyed the Netflix version of Daredevil.
I would strongly agree. You know, look, you and I talk about Marvel TV shows a lot on this show. And I feel like sometimes we usually get them early in the run. And sometimes I feel like we give a pass to shows that, you know, down the line don't really end up being as good as we thought they were going to be. I don't have that feeling about this Daredevil show. They do a bunch of things well here, right? They move it away from Hell's Kitchen, which was always kind of hilarious given how gentrified Hell's Kitchen has been for most of our lives, really, that the show took place in quote-unquote Hell's Kitchen, which may have been rough in New York in the 70s when, or 60s and 70s when Daredevil was created, but certainly wasn't by the time the TV shows started coming out. And they've moved it, they've broadened the lens, and it's kind of New York as a whole. And because of that, it's actually more recognizably New York than the Hell's Kitchen setting of the Netflix shows, which was almost like a cartoon version of a gritty New York that didn't quite exist.
Yeah, a lot of steam and smoke. That's how you know that it's a rough place, that there's a lot of steam all over the
place. And warehouses, of course. full of Russian guys driving SUVs. Yeah, you know, I guess it was before congestion pricing, which is now also gone. But regardless, I think they've done a nice job with that. And also, like, you know, the Kingpin character, we saw him, he was in that show Echo that you and I liked to start out with and then kind of liked a little bit less. And they acknowledge that story took place, but I feel like you don't need to have watched Echo in order to catch up with the Kingpin here.
Absolutely not. I think it provides a lot of really interesting context for people who like to deep dive, people who are fans, but it is in no way necessary to the plot of this series or what's going on. I think it is really interesting and illuminating to see the character arc of the Kingpin and how he went from crime lord to kind of nurturing and mentoring Echo, who winds up shooting him in the face when she finds out how evil he is and what he's done to her and her family. And then he's recovering from that. So he's wounded too and trying to come back and, you know, according to him, trying to do good things for the city of New York. But of course, we know that he's just consolidating power and kind of aiming at becoming a dictator or a despot.
I love how messed up his marriage is, too.
I know. Oh, my God. They go to marriage counseling, and there's a new character here that we can talk about, Heather Glenn, who is played by Margarita Leveva? I can't pronounce her name. I'm sorry. I'm tripping on it. But she's great. And she plays a therapist who is set up on a date with Matt Murdock, and they start dating. And turns out that she becomes Kingpin and Vanessa's marriage counselor, which is just as spectacularly awkward as you would hope. I thought that was a delightful little scene.
Speaking of the date, Can we just talk about what an absolute pimp Matt Murdock is, right?
Oh, super pimp.
I mean, he part of his Daredevil powers must be that he puts out some kind of pheromones. Because, I mean, he slept with She-Hulk in the She-Hulk series. That is not something that the average man can accomplish. And he's just always literally melting women with his vibe, I guess.
Oh, yeah. He is, in Dungeons & Dragons terms or role-playing game terms, he has maximum charisma, which is interesting for kind of a brawler of a superhero. But yeah, he just exudes confidence, and I don't know, he's got the Kvorka, man.
He's macking it. And you know, that's the thing. It's like, look, superheroes always are having girlfriends and having relationships, but no one is like just constantly butter talking women to bed as much as Daredevil. There's no character. I can't think of any character in all of like televised or film that does that as much.
Agreed. And, you know, I got to give it to Charlie Cox is that he portrays this character who is very charismatic and is, you know, hitting it off with the ladies in a way that it is so wholesome and not creepy at all, no. Which is clearly a challenge for a charismatic male character. So Charlie Cox really nails it there.
Yeah.
Also, just the inner conflict and just the anger that he feels conflicting with his sense of justice and righteousness. This is something that is not new to him. He's clearly done it before in the Netflix series. But it's a really great reminder seeing him in the roles, getting to see see him a little bit longer than the little cameos that we've seen in other shows.
How good he is.
It just reminds us of how talented an actor he is and what a great casting.
He really embodies Daredevil as much as, say, Hugh Jackman embodies Wolverine. I can think of very few other actors who really it's one of the great superhero performances ever.
Yeah, Ben Affleck doesn't even hold a candle to this Daredevil for sure.
Oh yeah, Ben Affleck played Daredevil. Yeah, no, not even close. I mean, he didn't have as much material to work with, but Charlie Cox is like literally. You look at the comic books and you look at him, and you're like, well, that's He just kind of he really knows what he's doing there. So you know, this is good. Daredevil is good. I think interesting modern comparison. I wanted to spend our last minute or so talking about this is the Penguin series, which we have spoken about on the show.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, which I don't think this is as good as Penguin. You know, the Penguin series was just so amazing and like peak TV amazing, like Sopranos level amazing. And this is still definitely an MCU product, but it's, you know, it's in that vein, right? Of sort of comic book as urban realism, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what one thing that both of these series are getting really right now is using New York City as its own character and like really kind of diving into, you know, the deeper machinations of the politics involved with the police and the politicians and the people on the street who are suffering and have different ideas. Because, of course, the Kingpin is running on a platform of anti-vigilantism, of course. And a lot of people are behind that and other people say like, wait, we need these vigilantes because our lives suck and it's filled with crime. And, you know, having lived in New York for a dozen years, like I understand that clash of social, you know, social groups and classes and all that sort of stuff. And it really does feel like they get it. You know, it's not it is a cartoon New York, but it's also a little bit deeper of a cartoon of New York.
Not so much. I mean, yes, it's not exactly New York, but it is, it's close. It's close enough that if you have lived there or spent any time there, you can recognize it. And so, you know, it's good that way. And I like how there's a whole world of kind of street level heroes and anti-heroes. And it's, you know, this is definitely like, they really take the street level thing to heart. This is not Marvel up in the stars. This is definitely like, you know, kung fu fighting on the subway.
Yeah. And I'm really happy to see that again. Like it's cool to see, you know, like space battles and lasers and aliens and stuff like that. But sometimes you just want to, you know, you want a little gritty realism. You want to go down on the street and get dirty in the gutter. And I think Daredevil does that really well.
It does indeed. All right. Well, Scott, you managed to get through this entire interview without your magic amulet.
I know. I am powerless without it. And we didn't even talk about Michael Gandolfini's appearance on the show. And I think he's definitely worth noting maybe a little bit.
He plays the assistant to Kingpin. He's the young assistant.
He does.
Yeah. He's really quite good, actually.
He is. And he isn't. Before I recognized that he was James Gandolfini's son, I was like, well, this is an interesting casting choice because, you know, he's not. you know, this traditionally handsome actor guy. Like, he's clearly like his affectations are a little bit different, but not in a bad way at all. And I think he's very good. And I think he's an excellent choice. He totally sells the character of, you know, this kid from the streets who believes in Wilson Fisk and is, you know, trying to, you know, do his best to kind of worm his way up in the world and up in the system. And I get it. And I think he does a great job. And I just wanted to throw out a shout out to Mike Gandolfini here.
All right. Well, the Gandolfinis are back. He kind of just like he's an heir to the throne, just like say Cooper Hoffman is to Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah,
so
there you go.
They even have similar body types. So here's to slightly chubby, extremely talented Nepo babies. Scott Gold, you have fought crime ably. You know, go back to brooding in the dark.
I will see you in the shadows, Neil.
All right, thank you so much, Scott Gold. Scott is a superhero living in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I am a superhero living in Austin, Texas. My name is Neil Pollack, and Scott and I discussed Daredevil Born Again, which is airing now on Disney+. Also, thanks to Stephen Garrett, who lives in the actual New York City, and we talked about Bong Joon-ho's new movie starring Robert Pattinson, Mickey 17, a sci-fi satire. Your mileage may vary on Mickey 17. It's kind of getting mixed reviews, but look, it's a new Bong Joon-ho movie, so if you love movies, you got to see a new Bong Joon-ho movie when it comes out. We don't get them all that often. Thank you so much for listening to the Book and Film Globe podcast. Again, I'm Neil Pollack. We bring you this show every week, and we bring you fresh content nearly every day on Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for reading the site, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.